Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and every major podcast provider. So if you can't catch the show live, you can download it or simply use your free podcast player, which is available on our website at www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post your question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter too, at The Organic View, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@theorganicview.com. In this special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my co-host Tom Theobald and I are going to be joined by several beekeepers today to celebrate Thanksgiving. And joining us today will be Steve Ellis, who is the Secretary of the National Honeybee Advisory Board, Miles McGahey, who is the President of the Boulder County Beekeepers Association, Don Studinski, who is the Chairman of the Pesticide Committee of the Colorado State Beekeepers Association, and environmental author and honeybee advocate, Graham White. So I would first like to welcome to the show my co-host, Tom Theobald. Good afternoon,
Hello,
Tom.
Hello, June.
Hi, Happy June. Thanksgiving. And also, I would like to first welcome to the show Miles McGahey. Happy Thanksgiving, Miles.
Happy Thanksgiving, June.
And next, Don Studinski. Happy Thanksgiving, Don.
Same to you, June. Glad to be here.
And also, Graham White, who is calling in from Scotland. Good afternoon, Graham, or good evening, and happy Thanksgiving. Now, as everyone knows, with Thanksgiving is the holiday where all sorts of different special foods are being served, and we celebrate the things that we are thankful for. But many of the foods that we enjoy would not be on the table if we didn't have our friend the honeybee. So I'd like at this point to allow Tom Theobald to talk about some of the things that he would like to share with our audience about Thanksgiving. Tom?
Thank you, June. More and more people are becoming aware of the challenges that the pollinators are facing, particularly the honeybees. And one of the facts that's thrown out in almost every interview is that the honeybees are responsible for about a third of the American diet. And we thought that was a little abstract, and we thought maybe we could take a look at a typical American meal, food by food, and just talk a little bit about the role that the honeybee and other pollinators play in the appearance of that on the table. And there's no more typical meal for most Americans than Thanksgiving. So that was what we have in mind, and we'll probably get astray at times, but that's the theme that we'd like to follow, is to take a look at a traditional Thanksgiving meal and discuss how the pollinators play into that feast.
Thank you. And Tom, before we begin, can you explain to our audience some of the key crops that honeybees are responsible for pollinating that we, as a country, have grown to enjoy?
Well, it's interesting. The commodity crops are, to a large extent, wind-pollinated, not insect-dependent. Things like corn and rice and wheat. It's just the good stuff that the bees are responsible for, the strawberries and the melons and the pumpkins and the cranberries and the blueberries and things like that. The figure that I've seen is that pollinating insects are responsible for about 80% of the flowering plants of the world. And the honeybee really is the workhorse in that equation. It's interesting. It has an interesting history in this country, and appeared not long after the first Thanksgiving. The first record that we have of of honeybees in North America. They're not native to North America. They were brought across the North Atlantic to Virginia in 1622. That's the first record that we have. They had evolved with the old world crops, many of which the first settlers had brought with them. And in the absence of the honeybee, some of these old world crops failed to thrive. So the bees were brought over soon after settlement. And we think that the early settlers understood the pollination connection, and most likely they did. But there was another interesting aspect to bringing the bees over, and that was that beeswax represented the highest lighting technology of the time. Beeswax candles were very important, and only the well-to-do or the peasant community enjoyed beeswax candles. Everybody else had to settle for tallow candles made with animal fat. Those had to be trimmed regularly. They smoked badly. They smelled bad. And so that is how the honeybee got over here. And it's an integral part of our environment now and of our agricultural system.
And I was talking to Graham White earlier about some of the information that he was reading about the history. So I would like at this point to have Graham just elaborate and share some of the information that he's been reading about with our audience. Graham?
Well, hi, June. Thanks. Graham White here in Scotland, and I think I've managed to connect at last. Yeah, I was, I guess my ideas of Thanksgiving are just having shared it with American families when I've been over there, and it's a great festival that we don't have here in the UK at all. And I was fascinated to learn that the first settlers who landed in Plymouth made friends with the Wampanoag Indians, who are what we call Native Americans or indigenous people. And they lived in a huge area that covered all of Cape Cod, Rhode Island, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, all that area. And they gifted corn or maize to the settlers, and it more or less saved their bacon, because without corn and pumpkins and turkeys, the settlers weren't very good farmers to begin with, so they might not have made it without the native people's help.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned turkeys. Tom, could you share with our audience just how dependent the turkey industry is, needs the help of the honeybees to pollinate many of the foods that are fed to the turkeys?
Well, you catch me a little off guard. I'm not sure exactly what the turkeys are fed, but it's...
Well, these days,
bees,
who knows, but...
yeah. The bees are essential for the production of many of the things that would go into a turkey's diet. Certainly not the wheat or the corn, because those are wind pollinated, but some of the miter additives. And someone told me just recently that frequently turkeys are fed alfalfa hay or hay fed as meal or pellets. That certainly would require the honeybee. The honeybee is a major pollinator of alfalfa seed crops, and not responsible for the plant itself, but for if I were a farmer and I wanted to grow alfalfa, I would have to get that seed somewhere, and the honeybee plays a major role, along with the alfalfa leaf cutter bee, in the pollination of those seed crops. It's a lot of the goodies that are on our table tomorrow that the bee is essential for. They're essential, for example, for the melon family. Cucumbers is an example that we always use. Cucumbers they're compartmentalized. They have several ovum, and each one of those has to be fertilized, and each one of those requires an individual visit by a pollinator. In the one day that a cucumber flower is open, it has to be visited 14 times. And if it isn't, and many gardeners will relate to this, if it's inadequately pollinated, you'll get a deformed cucumber. with a kink in it or a narrow waist, that's an example of inadequate pollination. So the pumpkins, we certainly would have pumpkin pie on the Thanksgiving table. Cranberries. I have friends who pollinate the cranberries. That's part of their business. They're contracted by cranberry growers to bring bees in to pollinate the cranberries. Blueberries are the same thing. We all know beekeepers who go north to Maine to pollinate blueberries.
And let's not forget our go ahead, Graham.
I was going to say it's worth mentioning the wild bees, not just the honeybees, because I read last year that there was a major disaster in one part of the USA where pumpkins are grown commercially, and they really need bumblebees or honeybees to pollinate them, and they started using neonicotinoids on the pumpkins, and they lost virtually the entire crop in that county, and it was quite a famous disaster. They had to think again about what they were doing.
Thank
yes,
you.
There's a native blueberry bee that I'm told is worth about $20 per bee.
Wow.
In the pollination that it provides. Unfortunately, given the scale of agriculture today, we can't really rely on the native pollinators alone. It requires the honeybee. It requires saturation pollination to secure an economically viable harvest.
Now, speaking of which, my next question is for Miles McGahee. Miles, can you share with our audience about what the commercial beekeepers in your part of the country are experiencing due to the increased use of neonicotinoids?
Well, since the introduction of neonicotinoids, the winter mortality rates have started to skyrocket. Typical winter mortality was around 3 to 5% and considered acceptable. And now it's between 30 and 50%. And in the case of beekeeping, beekeepers may be their own worst enemy. This may have been going on for quite some time since the introduction. And beekeepers are very adept at taking what they have left and splitting it and growing a new colony. The losses may well be above 50%. There are commercial beekeepers that are splitting their colonies two or three times and report upwards of 100% mortality, but in the face of all of those splits, they're hanging on by the skin of their teeth. A small operator like myself with only 120 hives, in 2006 I suffered 90% losses and went from 120 to 12 hives. That was the worst I've ever experienced or heard about in my vicinity, and I was following all of the best practices, protocols, and so on. This is an insidious form of insecticide because it leaves you with very little to test because the bees don't return home. And the losses have been staggering. One wonders how much longer this can continue. It's an unnatural state bringing in new bees every year from organically managed areas that are doing really well and thriving and putting them into an environment that's highly toxic to their well-being. In what may look pristine, and Boulder County is famous for beautiful mountain scenery and a lovely location, but in reality, as we release these bees into the environment, they suffer huge losses and dwindle down. It may assist in vectoring other viruses and things we have yet to understand now, which all ends up in mortality of bees. And it's this year coming to a head in the almond pollination, which is the largest pollinated crop in America, and it's billions of dollars at stake to those almond farmers and the beekeepers who supply pollination, in that if there's not enough pollination for those almond trees, they have a very small dwarfed crop. They can't even get crop insurance anymore unless they can prove that they have two colonies per acre of bees. They can't get insurance for it. And so So they're well aware of the need for this pollination service. At the same time that's going on, bees are plummeting across the country to the point where it's getting marginally impossible to get enough bees to the right place at the right time. And commercial beekeepers are, you know, creating Herculean efforts to make that happen. At some point, we'll reach a critical tipping stage, and some of those farmers are going to be without bees, and those that do get bees are going to be expensive. And, you know, and I guess in reality, June, a lot of people, you know, a singing insect, this little bug that's kind of mysterious to everybody in a lot of ways, is the linchpin to this whole environmental situation we find ourselves in with systemic pesticides. And this little bee isn't that important in a lot of people's minds, but don't we all like to eat on a regular basis? And don't we all like the variety of life? And really, this is the warning now from this little insect that these things are in jeopardy. And if we don't start to take them seriously, we may all begin to skip a few meals. And if not skip meals, certainly notice a drastic reduction in the variety and quality of fare that's available at any local supermarket.
Exactly. Thank you, Miles. Now, my next question is for Don Studinski. Don, can you tell our audience about exactly how much of an increase in use of neonicotinoids you've seen as far as Colorado, but also what you've observed as far as the United States in general?
Actually, I don't have statistics on that, June.
Well, just from your own experience, just especially with your position on the Pesticide Committee for the Colorado State Beekeepers Association, what have your observations been?
Well, it's upwards of 90% of all the corn is neonicotinoid corn. It's similar numbers for rapeseed, which is canola. Neonicotinoids are being used on cotton. The list goes on and on. It's literally, you know, hundreds of millions of acres of our land throughout the United States that we are covering with these poisons.
This is Tom. Now that we've cheered everybody up so much, let's talk a little bit about the food. Let's talk a little bit about the Thanksgiving table. And Miles mentioned the almonds. The almonds are directly dependent upon the honeybee. They're probably the most dramatic example of dependency that we have. If I were an almond farmer and I was able to put two colonies of bees in each acre, I would expect on average maybe 2,600 pounds of almonds. If I had no bees, that would drop to about 60 pounds per acre.
Wow.
2,600 pounds versus 60 pounds. Now, some plants...
60 pounds would be produced by native pollinators, right?
Well, no. You see, the almond orchard is... The almond area is such a monoculture that they virtually
have... It's a desert for insects.
It would be incidental pollination, maybe by the few insects that survive, and wind and accident. Virtually nothing. But many of the other things we have on the Thanksgiving table are directly dependent, and pumpkins are a perfect example. There would be no pumpkin pie. Blueberries are dependent upon both native pollinators and honeybees, but where blueberries are raised, there aren't enough native pollinators to cover the pollination requirements. Beekeepers move colonies into the blueberry fields for pollination. But there are some other interesting connections. For example, not only would we not have pumpkin pie for dessert, but we probably wouldn't have any ice cream to go along with it. And I used to go to the schools and talk to the kids and about the importance of the bees years ago, and we'd talk about what foods came from the bees, and I'd always mention ice cream, and they'd all look at me and scowl and say, oh, no, no, not ice cream. Well, the connection is that the bees, the honeybees, along with the leafcutter bees, play a significant, a crucial role in the production of seed for alfalfa. Alfalfa is a primary food source for dairy cattle. And without that alfalfa for food, you don't have the milk. Without the milk, you don't have the ice cream. So the connection goes through the whole food chain. Cranberries, we mentioned cranberries. What are some of the others that I'm not thinking of? What are some of the other things that would be bee-dependent?
Dolly, there's got to be a lot of the fruits and stuff associated with fruit salads. And
certainly.
A lot of the sweets, and we could talk directly to bees and honey there for a moment if we're talking about homemade pumpkin pie. My wife's recipe has a fair amount of honey in it, and you know, it was the first and most readily accepted form of sweetener for a long, long, long time, and the human race has a lot to thank the bees for in that regard, bringing a little touch of sweetness to this brutal planet sometimes. But, you know, there's more than just the physical loss of a species or a certain food. I think we're talking about something that's kind of ingrained in all of us at childhood or somewhere about maybe Winnie the Pooh age, where we start to look on bees as the noble creature that's kind of our ambassador to nature. And that ambassador is sending a warning right now, and not many people are heeding it yet. I suspect that that'll increase. One wonders if, you know, if there are enough native pollinators to take over. I used to raise bumblebees for greenhouse tomatoes in winter pollination. And we've lost several species of native bumblebees here in Colorado, and I suspect that these neonicotinoids are not only impacting managed honeybees, those are the ones we recognize because we're in there all the time studying those. But I think if we would contact the Xerxes Society, they would tell us that these same insecticides are just destroying populations of native pollinators too. So when we think about, well, maybe there would be some way to get a native pollinator going there, they're being attacked just as virulently with these neonicotinoids as the honeybees are.
There was an article in the Ames, Iowa paper a little over a year ago reporting on the concerns of a biologist at Iowa State, I guess it would be, and he had been monitoring the populations of native pollinators in Iowa for the past 10 years and was concerned, distressed, that those populations had dropped by about 80% in that 10-year period. And the concerning thing is that Iowa is the heartland of corn and soybean production, and as a consequence, the heartland of the use of these new agricultural technologies that concern us. So the native pollinators aren't monitored as closely as the honeybees are, but they certainly are in decline from what we have been able to determine.
Graham, you want to comment?
Can I just mention
sure.
that there's a very important scientific paper that's made waves all around the world. There are two researchers at Stirling University here in Scotland, a man called Professor Goulson and a lady called Whitehorn. And Whitehorn and Goulson fed bumblebees with the same level of neonicotinoids they get in the crops, and they found, to their astonishment, that the bumblebee colonies produced 80% fewer queens than they normally would. Now, if you have an area that's got bumblebees and every year they produce 80% fewer queens, within a couple of years, those bumblebees are extinct. And the irony is that bumblebees are protected under national law and they're protected under international law because they're a species, whereas no one gives a damn about honeybees because they're not considered to be wild creatures anymore. They're domesticated. So there's a considerable amount of controversy, you know, every university in the world is discussing this at the moment, and it looks like the bumblebee may be the savior of the honeybee, because the government can ignore the bumblebees being wiped out, but it can't ignore the bumblebees. The bumblebees are protected by law, and if the government fails to protect them, then the government is guilty of a crime. So there you go.
Well, unfortunately, with the human condition being what it is, until things get much worse, that's only when things will get better. I mean, that's generally how we are as a species. And, you know, it's getting really, really bad. And, I mean, Tom and I, each week, we talk to different scientists and experts and other beekeepers, such as Miles McGahee, Don Studinski, Graham Wade, Phil Chandler, so many different folks that have come on the show to talk about what their experiences have been, or their research, or just their observations. And, you know, we're at a critical point where if our, not just the society in general, but if the government, all of the different governments that are allowing the use of neonicotinoids in agriculture do not cease the use of these chemicals, we're going to be facing a very, very drastically different world that is not going to have the opportunity to make a comeback. There isn't really any type of anything that they can do once they're gone.
I think what people have to realize, and I'm not sure how many people do realize this, in America, for example, you have roughly 200 million acres of crops, that's corn, soya, cotton, and so on, that are treated with neonicotinoids every single seed, every single year, year after year after year. Now, in the past, insecticides used to be used as a reaction to an invasion of insects, but the way they're being used now is as a precautionary insurance. That means that 200 million acres of America are basically poisonous to all forms of insect life year after year after year. And we've got the same thing on a smaller scale here in the UK. And that's a revolution. That's an incredible change. Here we're seeing the disappearance of bees, birds, amphibians, frogs and toads and newts on a massive scale. But the people who are doing this have so much economic power and so much pull with government that it's going to take the citizens of America in particular to get up and start making a row about this before it's too late.
Graham, this is Tom. Could you just touch briefly upon what's proposed in Mexico with corn?
Well, the big crisis at the moment is that Monsanto has, you probably know that Mexico is the original birthplace of corn. That's where all the maize in the world came from, and the native peoples of America have been cultivating corn, we think, for 10,000 years. Monsanto has an application in to plant 2.4 million acres of Mexico with Monsanto's genetically modified corn, which contains insecticide. And if they get that permission and it goes ahead, and that's going to happen in the next 12 days, apparently, that means the end of thousands of varieties of native American corn, which are grown all over Mexico, Guatemala, Bolivia, Peru, and so on. Because
well,
the pollen from...
Virtually
pollen
a genetic reserve.
It is a genetic reserve, and the pollen from that GM corn will cross-contaminate every other single remaining variety. And that is incredibly dangerous. That is plain...
It sounds like market domination through cross-contamination.
It is, exactly.
And once the genie is out of the bottle, it can't be put back in again. It's an irreversible disaster.
Well, you see, very, very briefly, if you have 1,000 varieties of corn, that's an incredible safety reserve. It's like a pyramid with a half-mile base. You can't knock it over. But if you just put in one variety of GM corn, that's like building a single tower brick on brick that's only one brick wide, and you can push that over with a strong wind or a heavy rain shower. And they're pushing us from an incredibly stable food position to a very unsafe one.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. Tom, I'm sorry, but we are out of time. I just want to thank all of you for coming on the show today And Graham, thank you so much for the information. And I'd like to just give you each an opportunity to just wish our audience a happy Thanksgiving. I'd like to start with Miles.
I'd just like to remind everybody that there is nothing that a group of people meeting together can't change. In fact, that is almost the root of every change. And thank you for having me.
Thank you. And Don, a quick wish for our audience for Thanksgiving?
He's gone, I think.
Yeah.
And Graham, if you could share with our audience the Thanksgiving wish.
I'd just like to echo, have a great Thanksgiving, and remember that the only thing required for evil to exist is that people of goodwill do nothing.
And Tom.
Well, I'd just like to say that if we don't see changes soon, what we will have on the Thanksgiving table is the silverware, the glassware, the china, and maybe if we're lucky, the turkey. Most of the rest will be gone.
Exactly. And that's exactly what we need to think about this Thanksgiving, because next Thanksgiving, we may not see the things that we've enjoyed for so many years. And folks, once again, if you gobble till you wobble, thank a beekeeper. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.